Hello, ho, 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 and welcome to the program.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
Well, it's that time of year again, and despite the strange times we're living in, given the recent relaxation of restrictions, I think it's possible for most of us now to look forward to some kind of togetherness over the festive season. Now, we really can dream of a bright Christmas.
I am dreaming of a white Christmas.
This is our Christmas gift special, and this year our focus is firmly on books. Today, the team will be bringing you a super range of ideas for presents, all inspired by the natural world. So sit back and relax as we take you to the Mooney Goes Wild virtual bookshop. Anna hears how humble headlice drove the fashion for flouncy wigs in the 18th century in the History of the World in 100 Animals. Niall has got something for everyone on his whistle-stop tour of Birdwatch Ireland's bookshelves. And who knew that rats could laugh? Richard exposes the secrets of the animal mind.
If we look back in the history of the science of animal cognition, questions about whether animals are conscious or whether animals engage in intentional communication, scientists have not been allowed to answer these questions because they think that they are fuzzy or unscientific. And instead, what we found is that when we start asking these sorts of questions, we get really interesting answers. That scientists and philosophers working together can help figure out how to ask the questions well so that we can answer them and understand better what's going on in the non-human animal mind.
And don't worry if you miss any details, because you can find all the information on everything we mentioned today on our website rte.ie/Mooney. First up, it's the Q pocketbook on cacti.
Cattle prowl and the coyotes howl out on the great divide. Never done no wrong, just singing a song as down the trail I ride. Rattlesnakes rattle at the prairie dogs, you can hear that moanful tune. Cause it's roundup time away out west when the cactus is in bloom. The
Yes, when you hear the word cactus, it's impossible not to think about cowboys, cattle and coyotes and all the other clichés that go with those wonderful westerns of yesteryear. The mere mention of the name conjures up visions of a solitary hero, sun-drenched, parched, plodding hopelessly through the scorching desert heat, with that green, prickly cactus standing proud and tall, far off in the hazy distance. Cacti are among the most instantly recognisable plant forms, and movies apart, in the real world, they've become icons of desert habitats. In fact, a cactus forms the centrepiece of the Mexican flag. And closer to home, they've become increasingly popular as ornamental houseplants. The cactus is the latest species to feature in the Kew Pocketbook series. Dr. Matthew Jebb, director of the National Botanic Gardens of Ireland, spoke to Dr. Alwyn Grace, senior research leader in comparative plant and fungal biology at London's Royal Botanic Gardens.
This is a remarkable little pocket book on cacti. Owen, the evolution of cacti is something extraordinary. Where did this group of plants come from and why?
They do indeed have an extraordinary story of evolution. So quite remarkably, cactus experts have estimated that the ancestors of cacti as we know them today were actually quite leafy, woody plants, not like the characteristic columnar cacti or the barrel cacti that we so love to see in a botanic garden or indeed in the wild. So actually, the ancestors to the cacti would have been these leafy, woody trees and shrubs, quite a lot like the genus Pereschia, which now occurs in Central and South America, you know, Mexico and Brazil. And from there, they gave rise to this extraordinary array of very architectural plants, these plants that we so appreciate in horticulture. And the reason that those plants have these amazing forms is actually mostly to hold a reservoir of water-storing tissue, which allows them to survive periods of drought. And it's this ability to store water that actually requires the plant to look rather weird and wonderful. So there's no need for the usual woodiness or leafiness, but rather the whole plant body has become transformed in order to deal with these very challenging circumstances, particularly in deserts. You know, desert plants have a multitude of things to contend with, a particular set of challenges, which include a shortage of water, high light intensity, and large temperature variation, which means the days are very hot, but often the nights are very cold. And this particular set of challenges requires a very particular set of adaptations, which are perfectly illustrated by the cactus family.
And one of the amazing things, I suppose, in travelling to the Americas is to realise that when you go into forest there, you can sometimes find cacti growing on tree branches, and many of them don't even look like typical cactuses.
Yes, again, so this is the extraordinary diversity of the cactus family. This is one of the largest flowering plant families on Earth today, with nearly 2,000 species. And what's really remarkable, as you say, is this diversity in form. So plate number 27 in the pocketbook, the Rhipsalis pachyptera, is a good example of a cactus that doesn't really look like a cactus. It's an epiphyte that grows in trees. It has these exquisite white flowers along the margins of the flattened stem, and these flowers then give rise to very beautiful, almost translucent white berries, and those are what really give this group of epiphytic cacti, the Rhipsalis genus and pseudo Rhipsalis as well. That's why they're called the mistletoe cacti, which is actually quite seasonal, given that this pocketbook might be on people's Christmas lists.
Oh, and one of the great things, I suppose, about cacti in cowboy movies and so on of the past is there are a lot of myths have built up. I suppose one being that somehow cacti are indestructible, as they almost need no water at all.
Well, cacti might seem indestructible, and indeed those gorgeous silhouettes of the saguaro cactus, Carnegiea gigantea, which occurs in the southwestern US and is a frequent backdrop to cowboy films. Those towering columnar cacti seem indestructible, but actually they're not entirely. And actually one of the major threats to cacti is due to climate change. All plants with quite specialized habitat preferences like cacti tend to have a very limited natural range, and therefore they're likely to be most severely impacted by climate change because their habitats change faster than they can adapt and keep up. And additionally, the other main threat to cacti is the risk of habitat loss as natural habitat is converted to agricultural land or urbanization, and those reasons. So although cacti seem very indestructible, in fact, they're as threatened with extinction as many other groups of plants. And this is something to be very mindful of. But on the other hand, they have this extraordinary set of adaptations that allow them to prevail in some very harsh climates. So deserts are very hot places with high levels of light radiation and frequently a severe shortage of water. And this is what, that set of difficult circumstances was what these plants have specialized adaptations to survive in harsh desert climates.
And indeed, it is the attraction of these plants that has made them so popular as houseplants. But there are two sides to this problem, that something as attractive as a cactus has actually created a problem for its survival in the wild, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I think, as you describe, one of the reasons that cacti are actually threatened with extinction is because of their immense popularity in horticulture. So many plants today are threatened with extinction due to climate change and the loss of their natural habitats. But with these very popular plants like cacti, the demand for plants and seeds for cultivation actually places an additional pressure on natural populations of cacti. And experts say that this is the main contributing factor to the extinction risk facing cacti today. So we recently at Kew published the State of the World's Plants and Fungi Report, where we published an estimate of about 40% of the world's plants are at some risk of extinction. And in the cactus family, that risk is about 30%. So we know that about a third of cacti are threatened with the risk of extinction. And of course, we're very worried about this.
How are people to know when they're buying cacti or growing cacti that they're not having a dangerous impact on the wild populations of these species?
That's a really important question. Cacti are so threatened with extinction. It's really important to know that what you're growing at home or what you're buying in the shops has come from a legitimate source. My best advice would be to only buy plants that come from a reputable nursery. And if you encounter a plant that is particularly large and mature, then ask questions about where that came from. If you find a really odd-looking specimen, or it's really old and mature, or you're promised material that has come from the wild, then you really need to ask why and where it came from, and does it have the right paperwork to accompany it?
And Olwen, one of the myths, I suppose, that we've been delivered is this idea that if you were trapped in the desert and you'd run out of water, as a sort of cowboy, say, on your horse, is there any way that a cactus could save your life?
Well, it's possible that this legend has its origins in the traditional uses of cacti by Native American peoples, and I've no doubt that a thirsty cowboy might have kept himself alive in the desert this way. But inside many cacti is actually more of a slimy mucilage than clear water that you could sort of scoop out and drink. And indeed, many cacti also contain some pretty toxic compounds, so I wouldn't recommend trying this at home.
And I suppose a question that we'll often be asked by a lot of people is, why would you say it is so important for us that cacti survive into the future?
Well, every extinction, of course, is a final non-reversible possibility. So extinction needs to be avoided at all costs. And the reality is that once a species is lost, the potential that species held for being a new source of medicine or energy, food, drought adaptations, all of that is lost. And without that potential, we're left with a very narrow pool of plant diversity with a more limited potential to help us as humans adapt to the future. My research really looks at unlocking the potential of these plants to solve challenges we face today. Things like energy poverty, soil erosion, climate change. These plants have evolved over millions of years to have very finely tuned adaptations to harsh desert conditions. And under anticipated climate change scenarios, we know that some deserts are likely to expand. We know that we're going to need plants that grow in hot, dry conditions. And having a full suite available, you know, all the biodiversity available to adapt to these challenges is what we need. And so ultimately, all cacti are going to be important in the future.
Oh, and thank you very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you.
You too. Thanks very much indeed, Matthew.
Thank you, Matthew and Dr. Olwen Grace. Cacti is the latest in Kew's pocketbook series and is available from kew.org.
Churchill comes over here to say we're doing splendidly, but it's very cold out here in the snow, marching to and from the enemy. Oh, I say it's tough, I have had enough, can you stop the cavalry?
Now we have a book that was written with the ambition of helping us to improve our understanding of our place in the world, so that we might do a better job of looking after it. And that, in turn, it might help save the polar bear, the modern emblem of impending loss and destruction. It might even save ourselves. That's what prompted award-winning author Simon Barnes to write The History of the World in 100 Animals. He selected the 100 animals who've had the greatest impact on humanity and on whom humanity has had the greatest effect. He shows how we have domesticated animals for food and for transport, and how animals powered agriculture, making civilization possible. In short, he charts the close relationship between humans and animals, finding examples from around the planet that tell this story with great insight and understanding. Simon Barnes told Eni Nilana what prompted him to write the book.
Well, I suppose there are two main reasons for inspiring it. The first was, of course, the great radio series and book from Neil McGregor, History of the World in 100 Objects, which struck me as just a classically beautiful, simple idea. The second one was an adventure I had in Africa one time when I walked into a male lion. I was just with a friend. We shouldn't have been there, really. We didn't have any guns or anything like that. But what struck me was the fact that I did exactly the right thing. I froze still, staring at the lion, and the lion backed down. And I will never forget that moment, obviously because it was terrifying. But this was an experience not of the humans as the great conquerors, but as humans as prey. I was being prey. I was being considered as prey for a short period of time that I will never forget. And that made me consider the place that we have in the world and the place that we humans have in the animal kingdom. And I also live with horses. I always lived with horses most of my adult life. And building my life around horses has been a crucial influence on the way I see the world. And so these things all coming together, it came to the book about how human life has been impacted by and has impacted on non-human life. So, I don't use the term animal specifically in the book. I prefer to use human animals and non-human animals to try and understand the closeness that we have between us. And choosing the 100 animals was a task and a half because there was never a question of how was I going to fill it up and make it 100. I could write a list of another 100 animals in a half an hour or so. There are so many to choose from, so many animals that have influenced human life, the way we think, the way we understand our place in the world today.
Yes, I mean, animals as hunters for humans, like humans being prey to lions, sharks, crocs, piranhas, maybe they're sort of things you might think of. But there were loads of things in the book that I had never thought of. I mean, I never thought, for example, that fashion was affected by animals. And when I thought of it just super, I came across it already, I said, oh yeah, that's probably the silkworm. But I was really intrigued that head lice affected fashion. Do you want to tell us how you came to that conclusion? What fashions were affected by a head louse?
Absolutely. We humans are animals and we have blood and we attract animals that feed on blood. Body lice mostly live in the clothes that we wear if they're not clean, which is why they flourish in places like refugee camps to this day. The reasons we're largely hairless is probably an evolution so that we don't carry lice on our most of our bodies. But for some complex evolutionary reasons, we've kept the hair on our heads. And then a subspecies, the head louse, that can find a living. That everybody who's ever had a child of school age or been one probably knows all about head lice and the awful irritation they are. They are not dangerous or life-threatening, but they are profoundly annoying to the possessor. There's one easy way to get rid of them, and that is to have no hair on your head. So if you get rid of the hair on your head, you do away with the head lice. However, that might leave you looking a bit bald and you might think a little bit unsightly. And so the fashion for wearing wigs for men and for women came into being and then reached its full luxuriance in the 18th century with the full bottom wig as most spectacularly worn by Louis XIV of France.
Yes, indeed. And the women in those times too had huge, enormous bouffant wigs, which in fact became infested with mice because they didn't bother taking them down for ages and they were held together with various glues and the like. But anyway, it was all banned by the end of the 1700s. The French thought this was a terrible decadence altogether. Now, one of the creatures that I'm in favour of, and I'm always trumpeting it, is the wasp. I think it's a much maligned creature, but I never thought In my wildest dreams, that wasps are responsible for all our literature. Now, how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I can remember the first time I saw a wasp's nest for real, and I was absolutely struck by their beauty. These animals that we mostly treat as wholly annoying create these little masterpieces of these tiny hexagonal cells that they make from chewed wood pulp. That is to say, paper. And the Chinese realized this, that wood pulp, as processed by wasps, could be processed by humans and use it to make paper. And they started to use paper for many things and eventually started to use it for writing, for recording information, for laying information down. And that meant that was the end of oral transmission as the only means of communicating complicated information from one person to another. It meant that knowledge could be stored. It meant that knowledge could be transported. It was as big a revolution as the invention of computers.
Yeah, one of the things that I find fascinating about the book is the interconnectedness between the chapters. Now, when I got it first, 100 different animals, right, I'll read two a day, three a day, whatever, make it last. I didn't want to gobble it all up in one fell swoop. But you found yourself in the middle of one chapter reading, say, perhaps about barnacles, and then you refer to the chapter on beavers then instead. You're reading about the pheasants and suddenly you have an irresistible urge to go to the section on rats or albatrosses because you have made wonderful linkages between one chapter and another, so you can put it down because whatever your trend you're following in one thing, you have to follow it up in the other chapters. How did you manage all this interconnectedness? Because it's really a very thrilling bit of the book. You could be there all day reading it rather than thinking 100 animals, well, I'll let it last for a long time. It's a one fell swoop book if you're not careful.
Well, I must say, you make me smile with great pleasure. That's very lovely of you to say that and to put it that way. And yes, I did try and make connections. I mean, and down for something completely different isn't always the best way of making your segue. So, I had a hard and fast list that I began with. But once I had begun, it was a largely intuitive way of saying, well, where do I feel like going after this? What is logical? You know, quite often, the research for the next chapter would reveal stuff I didn't know about or I knew about in general terms. And suddenly that would bring out, say, well, maybe we better go there next and so forth. So, yeah, you are the first person to tell me that that aspect of the book actually worked. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful to you for doing so because it's been a cause of concern. But yes, so thank you.
Well, that's good. I enjoyed the book and read it. Mind you, I pride myself in knowing loads of stuff, but there were three things in the book I never heard of. I never heard of a vaquita, I never heard of a seola or a loa loa worm, although I did hear of the loa loa worm when I realised that it was the worm that David Attenborough was describing that caused him not to believe in God anymore. But, you're describing something like the seola, something like the vaquita, and indeed your point out that in fact these animals, they're only after being discovered and they're on the way out. And in fact you end up as a conclusion for your book, a very sobering conclusion. We're looking at different animals throughout the centuries that have been made extinct by humans, but your conclusion at the end is that we humans ourselves are at a tipping point, that we actually have to act or we ourselves, the way we're treating the world, will go extinct, which is a rather sobering thought at the end of such a delightful book.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the problems with writing about nature without writing about wildlife at all, is that it's absolutely fabulous and glorious and wonderful. It's the most marvellous stuff in the whole world. But we can't take it for granted. We do have a part to play there. So I chose with Animal 100, which is the polar bear, to bring in this point about climate change. We're going through what we consider a fairly major crisis at the moment to do with the COVID virus. We are living through a far greater crisis when it comes to climate. And you have to make that point without a great pleasure in inflicting that point upon the readers. You have to make it. But I then went on to write a postscript because I felt that was important. I didn't want to leave on the kind of we're all doomed kind of note. So I finish and I flash back to a night in the rainforest in Borneo when I was sitting up in my hut, because everybody else had gone to bed, but I was sitting up because it was just too marvellous not to. And I sat there beneath the canopy of the trees beside the Kinabar Tangan River, listening to the night sounds, some of which I could interpret, frogs, crickets and so on, quite a lot of which I couldn't. And it was just that feeling of life teeming all around. This is absolutely the marvellous nature of rainforest and by extension of all life on Earth. And as I sat there in the night in the morning, I just thought, you know, we can do better than this if we make that decision. So the last chapter was perhaps a kind of extempore prayer saying, can we perhaps actually take this crisis seriously and really do something, because it's too marvellous to lose.
Thank you, Aina and Simon. The History of the World in 100 Animals by Simon Barnes is published by Simon & Schuster and is available from the usual outlets. Don't forget, all the information on the books featured in today's programme can be found on our website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, we are, it seems, living in a golden age of nature writing. This is very much attributable to digital fatigue and concern for the planet, not to mention the pandemic which has swept the world over the past 10 months or so. This year's motto for UNESCO's International Day for Biological Diversity was "Our solutions are in nature." And they highlighted that the appearance of COVID-19 has shown that when we destroy biodiversity, we destroy the system that supports human life. So it's a boom time for books inspired by the natural world. And Irish writers are there in the thick of it, producing more great work than ever before. This is a view that no doubt Niall Hatch will support as he browses the bookshelves of Birdwatch Ireland shop for our Mooney Goes Wild Christmas gift special.
Hello, Derek. It's a wet, windy day here in Kilcool in County Wicklow, and I'm at a location where I haven't been able to spend too much time in recent months. I'm at the door to Birdwatch Ireland's head office here in Kilcool, home to Birdwatch Ireland's shop. So I'm just going to get out of these elements here. Let's hope I can remember how to open this door. Okay. That's much better. Here, out of the elements now. Seems to have done the trick. Okay, so at the moment when I'm recording this, it's level 5 restrictions in place because of COVID-19, which has meant that myself and most of my colleagues have had to work from home. But some of my colleagues have been able to continue coming into the office because they're able to service Birdwatch Ireland's shop orders. We still have a very thriving business for online and mail order shop orders. And that's something that thankfully has been able to continue despite the level 5 restrictions. So for charity like ours here in Birdwatch Ireland, that's absolutely vital because the proceeds of sales from our shop orders go to support the work that we do. So I'm just going to walk through into the shop now, make sure I get the lights on here. Don't want to trip over anything. There are lots of boxes around the place because there's lots of Christmas orders going out now as we speak. It's like Santa's grotto in here. Just close the door behind me there, keep nice and warm. So this is where the magic happens, as they say. I'm in Birdwatch Ireland's shop. We have 15,000 members across the country, so there's lots of people out there, hopefully, who will buy Christmas cards from us, will buy our 2021 Irish Birds calendar with lots of lovely photographs on it. We also have lots of optical equipment. We have binoculars here, we have telescopes, a very wide range. We can give expert advice on which ones to choose and which are the best for different circumstances. We have lots of nest boxes. I must get some of those myself as Christmas presents for some of my friends and family, because it's a good time to put them up over the winter. You want to have them in place for the springtime when the birds will start to prospect for nest sites and work out where they're going to nest in the coming spring. We also have a wide range of bird food and bird feeders here. Very good way to benefit the birds twice, because not only are you feeding the birds in your garden, by buying from Birdwatch Ireland, you're also helping to support our work as a charity. So you're giving back to the birds in that way as well. We have lots of kids things here as well. We have a lovely range of toys, including these ones here. They're soft toys and they sing the real song of the bird when you squeeze them. So here's one here now. That's a chaffinch, if you were wondering, one of the stars of our Dawn Chorus programme every year. We always hear them in May. It's strange, actually, for me to hear one here at this time of the winter singing, even if it is just a recording. But right beside me here in the shop are our bookshelves, and they're my favourite thing of all in here. I love books about nature, and I have done ever since I was a small child. We have a wide range of different books in stock here, both from Irish authors and publishers and international ones as well. And there are lots of different books by Irish authors about aspects of Irish natural history on the market. So I've selected a few that I'd like to talk about and would suggest and recommend as Christmas gifts. The first one here on our list is just published. It's a brand new book called Wild Woods by Richard Nern. Now, Richard is he's an ecologist and a very experienced author. He's written many books, and he's spent a lifetime studying from nature, as he says himself. So he had an opportunity to buy a small area of woodland in Wicklow. And this book, Wild Woods, it's an account of a typical year in the life of these woodlands. It's obviously of great Irish interest because he's describing Irish plants and animals and the place that woods have in our culture and our history and our heritage, addressing why Ireland has so few woodlands as well. So there's lots to learn from that book. Highly, highly recommend it. Another book in a similar vein is called A Natural Year, and that's by Michael Feuer, who's probably best known as a critically acclaimed travel writer. But this one, he's celebrating the everyday wonder of Irish nature through diaries and the observations he makes both in South Dublin and in rural Waterford. And it goes through a year, sort of the natural history of the plants and animals that he's seeing. So that's of great interest for an Irish audience as well. And another travelogue about birds is one that we featured on the programme before. It's called Ireland Through Birds. It's by Connor W. O'Brien. What it is really, Connor is a naturalist and author who comes to birdwatching. He really wants to try and find 12 iconic species and track them down in Ireland and see what he learns about them and about the landscapes. Now, I don't want to give any spoilers, but some of them he manages to see, other ones he doesn't. But it's sort of a whole story of discovery about the birds and their places in the landscape. And it was nominated for several awards. So even people who aren't even that interested in nature would get a lot from it. The prose is absolutely beautiful. But if you are interested in nature and in particularly in birds, then this is a must buy. It's an absolutely wonderful book. Also then, going a little further afield, not just dealing with birds specifically, there's a great book called The Urban Wildlife Gardener. This is a new one by Emma Hardy, and it's a great if you want to know how to garden with wildlife in mind, how to make your garden as attractive as possible for birds, but also for pollinating insects, for mammals, for amphibians as well, if you can put ponds in. So it's a really excellent book. So anyone who is looking for a one-stop shop on how to make your garden more wildlife friendly, I would definitely recommend The Urban Wildlife Gardener by Emma Hardy. Now, one of the things that people most frequently want to know when they come to us here in Birdwatch Ireland, when they want recommendations for books, is how they can identify the different birds that they're seeing and other creatures as well, and also where they can go to find them. A couple of whom are very well known to listeners to Mooney Goes Wild already, who've written some absolutely excellent books that I highly recommend. The first one is The Complete Field Guide to Ireland's Birds by our very own Eric Dempsey, with lovely, lovely illustrations by Michael O'Cleary. Now, this is a wonderful book if you want to learn how to identify the different birds that you're seeing. It has wonderful range maps that are very accurate, so it shows you where in Ireland you're likely to see these birds, and also breaks down when you're likely to see them as well, so what time of year. So for people who like illustrated field guides with absolutely wonderful realistic drawings in it, I would highly, highly recommend this, The Complete Field Guide to Ireland's Birds. For those who prefer photographic field guides, there's a wonderful book called The Birds of Ireland, A Field Guide by our very own Jim Wilson, with photographs by his nephew, Mark Carmody. It's a wonderful book. It's been out for a couple of years now. It's endorsed by Birdwatch Ireland. We have our logo on the cover of it, and we're very proud to, because it's a really expert book. It really is a pocket guide as well. It would comfortably fit in a jacket pocket, but it gives you very good information about the different birds within Ireland. There's often a debate as to which is better, illustrations or photographs in a field guide. Personally, I would tend to prefer illustrations, because a good artist can capture many different aspects of the bird in one painting, whereas a photograph just shows one snapshot, literally, of that bird frozen in a moment in time. That's not necessarily representative of what it looks like when it's moving in the wild. However, what the Birds of Ireland Field Guide has done is use photographs, but then digitally manipulate them so they are as good as illustrations. So all of the key field marks, that's the identification points for the birds, are all there. So it's absolutely remarkable. And I have to say, Mark Carmody's photography here is stunning. So I'd highly, highly recommend that. And in the same series, there's an excellent book called The Wildflowers of Ireland, A Field Guide by Zoe Devlin. And it's exactly the same type of book, but instead of covering birds, it covers our wildflowers. So there's many different ways there to learn about nature. And I think that people often who are interested in birds soon develop an interest in other flora and fauna as well. So I'd heartily recommend both of those books. So The Birds of Ireland, A Field Guide, and The Wildflowers of Ireland, A Field Guide. Before I go on to the books that I'd recommend for children, because there are a couple of really lovely ones on the market now that have just come out, I just want to put in a quick word for Birdwatch Ireland's own scientific journal. It's called Irish Birds. It comes out every year and we're currently on number 42. So it's been going for 42 years. And for anybody who's interested in ornithology and in birds from a scientific point of view, I would highly recommend this. It's really the journal of record for ornithology within Ireland. It's a very well-kept secret. I think a lot of people aren't aware that it's there. So if you're just starting in bird watching, it's probably not for you. But if you're somebody who's very interested in learning more about the science behind Ireland's birds, what sort of surveys we're doing on them, this is very much the one for you. There's nowhere else you can get it that's exclusive to Birdwatch Ireland. Okay, on to some of the children's books. And the great news is the children today are spoiled with the choice that's available for them. There's lots of really great ones. So whatever aspect of nature or wildlife that children are interested in, there's going to be something that will suit them very, very well. One that I would like to recommend to begin with is a fantastic book called The Great Big Book of Irish Wildlife Through the Seasons. It's by Juanita Brown. It's beautifully illustrated, gives details all about Ireland's natural history. It really is all about exploring wildlife in your backyard, but also in the mountains, rivers, forests and seas, all about red deer ruts and how tadpoles metamorphosize into frogs, all of these things. It's a wonderful book. It's a great gift that really opens people's eyes to the environment. It's the book that will keep on giving. Another one that I would heartily recommend is Naturama, which is by Michael Feuer, with wonderful illustrations by Melissa Doran. It's a wonderful book all about Ireland's flora and fauna going through the seasons. It's a very large book, so it's a lovely one, big format that really lets those illustrations sing. They look absolutely beautiful. So it's great to see two such wonderful Irish products for children on the market. And for younger kids, I would highly recommend a great book called My First Book of Birds by Zoe Ingram. It's designed for very young children, and children from 4 years upwards will find this great. It's lovely information about the birds, lots of facts about them. It tells you about their lives and their diets, but they're also beautiful child-friendly illustrations, really colourful, really catches the eye. So lots of books there. We have a wider selection available at birdwatchireland.ie. That was just a quick snapshot of a few of the ones that I would recommend, but there's something there to suit everybody. And also one thing too that I'd love if people could consider as a gift option at Christmas, and that's membership of Birdwatch Ireland. So you can find full details about Birdwatch Ireland's membership at www.birdwatchireland.ie. That's all from me, Derek. I better get on and try and pack some of these orders to get them out in time for Christmas. So from here in Birdwatch Ireland's shop in Kilcoolan, County Wicklow, it's bye for now.
Thank you, Niall Hatch, Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland. And you can get details of everything Niall mentioned on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, the study of animal cognition throws up some fascinating questions about the minds of animals and indeed the philosophy of the mind itself. We need look no further than Rudolph to remind ourselves just how remarkable animals are. Aristotle said that only humans are able to laugh, but recent research shows that rats too actually enjoy a good giggle. Other experiments show that dogs have responded appropriately to more than 200 words in the human language. Kristen Andrews is Professor of Philosophy and a member of the Cognitive Science Programme in York University, Toronto. She's also author of The Animal Mind, an introduction to philosophy of animal cognition. In it, she explores key topics, including research into pain and emotions, moral reasoning and ethical behaviour. She asks big questions like, does behaviour have a cognitive basis? Do animal thought processes involve belief and concepts? And do animals have a language of thought? Our own resident philosopher, Dr. Richard Collins, spoke with Kristen.
Kristen, mind is a very flexible term. We talk about mind the gap and mindfulness and in her mind's eye and to my mind. Mind is an extraordinary term. It's very flexible. Now, the everyday person, such as myself, who doesn't think about these things very much, ordinarily thinks of mind as something going on in the head, a stream of consciousness, images, emotions, doubts and fears, plans, trying to go to sleep, these thoughts. This is what we think of as mind, a kind of an internal world. Now, is there any evidence that our nearest relatives, the great apes, the other great apes, because we are a great ape, have anything similar, a non-verbal version of that?
Absolutely. I think that we know quite a bit about the animal mind. And I think that this common sense view of the mind that you describe absolutely reflects what we see not just in the other great apes, but in other primates like baboons and vervet monkeys, in cetaceans like dolphins and whales, and even in our pets like dogs and cats, and farm animals like chickens. We are seeing mind everywhere. And one of the things that you might ask is, how do we know that these other animals have minds, right? But we can also ask this question about other humans. This is one of the oldest questions in philosophy. It's called the problem of other minds. How do we know that others think and feel the way we do? And a simple answer to that question is, we treat them like they think and feel, and we're able to interact with them. Our predictions bear out when we treat them as if they think and feel and have emotions. And that's the starting point with other species as well.
Now, you mentioned baboon there. The Shakma baboon has a most extraordinary sexual life. All sorts of shenanigans go on in baboon sexuality. Now, looking at it from the... I think I should get you to describe it, because you know about this. But surely it displays not just obvious things, but it seems to be able to infer and predict what the dominant male will do, and the female not crying out and so on. She is able to assess the situation and adapt her behavior accordingly. Anyway, I'll leave it over to you to go into this difficult but fascinating question.
Sure. One of the ways that we know that other animals have minds is that they seem like they understand that each other has a mind as well. So baboons, like humans sometimes, want to try to break the rules and want to kind of sneak away and have sex with someone they're not supposed to have sex with. And there have been observations of female baboons mating with male baboons who are lower ranking. Now, the higher ranking males want to preserve the females, the high ranking females, for themselves. But females are picky. We don't always want to do what the men want to do, that's for sure. And so they'll sneak off with the low ranking males. Now, by sneaking off, that means that the high-ranking males don't see that they're copulating, but also female baboons usually cry out when they have intercourse, and they will suppress their cry as well. So they're aware both of the visual access that gives information to others, and also the auditory access that that will give information to the dominant male about what they're doing. And this suggests that baboons have some skill with deception, that baboons are able to deceive other baboons, think about what they think, and try to keep information from them that they don't want them to have.
Well, now we are 7 million years separated from chimps. We had a common ancestor 7 million years ago. Now, to have the same thing with baboons, we'd have to go back around 24 million years or so. That suggests that mind, in the everyday sense in which you're using it, is very ancient indeed. Now, the other animal you mention is the dolphin. Now, dolphins are a very different kind of creatures. Is it true that they can pick up the echolocation pulses of their neighbors? And if they can do that, if they can actually tap into what's happening neurologically among other dolphins around them, they have a totally different picture of the world to us in this way as well as in every other way.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating when we look at other species and their different sensory modalities. So dolphins' echolocation allows them to kind of see objects, but it also allows them to see through objects. One thing that dolphins can do, as you described, is they can get the echolocation signal back from that another dolphin has sent out, so they can kind of share seeing with another dolphin. But they can also look inside other dolphins, and they can keep track of whether that dolphin is pregnant or what the heart rate is like in those dolphins. So they have access to this physiological information that some people have surmised suggests that they might have a much deeper connection than humans do, because we only observe the external signals of other people's bodies, whereas dolphins can see inside their conspecifics and group members' bodies. They know them really well from the inside out.
Does this explain the phenomenon of strandings? In other words, is there a kind of group mind among dolphins due to this commonality of pulses coming back in echolocation. That might explain why the whole school of them ends up dying on a beach, or would it?
So this has been surmised by some, like the philosopher Thomas White. But in a paper I wrote with Rebecca Ring and Sarah Vincent, we thought that the strandings might be explained by something else, and that is a kind of moral behavior in the dolphins. So morality is something that we typically have thought of as special to humans, right? That only we are able to think about right or wrong, what we ought to do and ought not do. But if you have very tight group cohesion, as dolphins do, and as many human societies do, then you need to have rules to live by, and you need to be able to support one another. And these mass strandings seems to occur when one of the group members gets into trouble and the other group members seek to help them. So it might be that there's a social norm that we are all working together to save these individuals and we're willing to go down with the group, as opposed to them actually having a single mind, right? We can still have multiple minds among group members, but we have a shared goal that we're all working for and think we ought to do it, even if maybe we don't really want to strand ourselves and die. We're willing to make that sacrifice because it's the right thing to do.
You mentioned multiple minds, and now the octopus. Could an animal or creature have more than one consciousness working independently? For instance, I gather that octopi expose their camouflage side to predators. They hide, but they expose their colourful side at the same time to potential mates. So each side is different. Now, we would suggest that there are two consciousnesses going on. Is that possible? Can we envisage that? A seal swimming puts half its brain to sleep and then the other half to sleep. Are there two consciousnesses going on in a seal?
Well, it's hard to say whether there are multiple consciousnesses going on, that's for sure. But it seems like in the octopus, there's some evidence that there are different, what you might say, drivers of action. So, for example, in the octopus, they have neurons in their central body and also in their legs. And they will sometimes engage in behaviors where they are using both of their central body and their arms in order to solve a maze task. And this integration of information from these two sources is sometimes looks like integrating information between two humans who are working together to track an animal or find something in the field, right? Using walkie-talkies to communicate to one another, that they're separate but able to communicate. Now, the coloring being shown to prey issue is something that I think it was the cuttlefish that do this. They will show different coloring depending on whether or not they are pretending to be a female versus not pretending to be a female, but are actually a male and trying to mate with a female. So these sorts of cases where there are different sorts of signals that are going on depending on who's looking at them is something that, again, suggests that there's some sort of deceptive activity going on. But I don't think it suggests that there are multiple minds or streams of consciousness in the animal. Simply, it would be more like me, if I'm trying to hide the fact that I'm scared, smile at you, as opposed to express the feeling I actually have, or smile when I look at one person and frown at the other person. I can control those signals in a way that it seems like some of these other animals can control their signals.
How far can we go with science in this area? If you take the philosophers, they have in recent centuries ruled out the possibility of envisaging what goes on in another creature's world. You take Kant and his forms and categories of the mind. We're locked into our subjectivity. We can't get out of that no matter what we do, outside the possible range of our experience. Now, are you reaching a limit? Is it like quantum mechanics, where everyday realism goes out the window and you live entirely in the world of equations? Is it something like that? Or are you envisaging a kind of alternative, non-visualizable universe?
I think it's nothing like that. So you should know, Richard, that I'm a philosopher. And I think that these sorts of questions that we have about the animal mind are best answered when scientists and philosophers work together. One of the things, if we look back in the history of the science of animal cognition, which I discuss in my book, questions about whether animals are conscious or whether animals engage in intentional communication. Scientists have not been allowed to answer these questions because they think that they are fuzzy or unscientific. And instead, what we found over the last 30, 40 years is that when we start asking these sorts of questions, we get really interesting answers. That scientists and philosophers working together can help figure out how to ask the questions well so that we can answer them and understand better what's going on in the non-human animal mind. What we found with when we started asking questions about communication, by assuming that animals are trying to communicate to one another, we can make predictions about what we expect them to do. So for example, in the case of chimpanzees, if a chimpanzee gives us a gestural signal, like reaches for an object that's desirable, a good piece of food, and an experimenter doesn't give them that piece of food, what does the chimpanzee do? Well, we might expect that if the chimpanzee was actually trying to communicate, please give me the food, that they will persist, they will continue the behavior. Or we might also predict that they will modify the behavior, they'll make it more vigorous, they'll shake their hand, or they will use an attention-getting signal, shake the bars of their cage, and that if they get the food, then they will stop with those behaviors. So this is a way we can scientifically validate this idea that the chimpanzee is actually trying to communicate with us. So now we know that there's communication in lots of different species, prairie dogs, meerkats, dogs, chickens, songbirds, dolphins, so on and so forth. There are other questions that scientists aren't really asking yet. These are questions about whether animals think about oughts, whether animals have social norms, whether animals engage in moral practice. And I think that the next move in the study of the animal mind is for scientists and philosophers to work together to figure out how best to answer questions about these sorts of capacities in other animals. I think we have preliminary evidence that there are social norms in chimpanzees, and some social norms would be things like infanticide avoidance, or helping others, or treating infants with care, respecting elders. So if we ask the right kinds of questions and figure out how to investigate them scientifically, I think that there is no limit to what we can discover. And I think that we're also giving a certain amount of credit to the kind of common sense understanding of animals that people have when they're living closely with these animals. When you're living in a city and the only animals you interact with are your pets and the pigeons and the raccoons outside your house, then you don't have a very deep understanding of what animals are like as they live together in their own communities. But people who live among the chimpanzees, people who live among the meerkats, both the scientists and the untrained people have a deep knowledge that I think is vindicated when we start asking these questions and studying them scientifically and philosophically.
Kristen, I am very pleased to hear you are a philosopher, because the philosophers have been losing out to the scientists since the 17th century. And here now is an instance of them fighting back, and I'm glad to hear it. Thank you, Kristen. That's a wonderful book.
Thank you, Richard. And I would say, watch out for the next generation of philosophers. They are going to blow your socks off.
Oh, great.
Something to look out for indeed. Thanks, Richard. The Animal Mind, an introduction to the philosophy of animal cognition, is published by Routledge and is available from all the usual outlets. And once again, find the details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
That's pretty much all we have time for you today, other than to say, if you haven't started your Christmas shopping yet, you'd better get your skates on. And with the range of options we've provided here today, you have no excuses. Keep reading alive. My thanks to researcher John Bell O'Reilly and my producer, Anna Leddy. We'll be back at the same time next week with a very special Mooney Goes Wildlife Quiz. Until then, goodbye.
Sure, it's Christmas. Once a more.
Up next, a late date with Cahill.